It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
I might get a young person in here who says, I just don't want to go to jail. And I say, you don't want a felony. And they go, I don't care about that. I just don't want to go to jail. And then 3 or 4 years later, they call me and say, hey, I got to get this felony off my record. And I say, well, there's no way that can happen, short of a pardon from the governor, which is highly unlikely. So you're stuck. And they're like, well, I didn't understand. And that's because they didn't want to listen.
Criminal defense lawyer Esther Windmuller reveals the troubling civil consequences of a criminal conviction affecting your ability to get employment, public benefits, housing, education, and even the right to keep your children. And in our weekly question and answer session, we'll find out about the protections available to victims of domestic violence and how to get those protections. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. This show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. The deadline for filing the needed forms to receive economic stimulus payments or tax rebates from the federal government is 1 week from today, Wednesday, October 15. Yet, almost 125,000 Virginians still have not filed. Many older and low-income residents who were not required to file income tax returns in 2007 don't realize they still qualify for the tax rebate. They still can receive a tax rebate by sending in a simplified tax form, even though the annual income tax deadline has passed. These payments, which are worth a minimum of $300 per person, could put more than $37 million into Virginians' hands. Again, the deadline for filing is October 15. It takes only a few minutes, and there are free resources for those who need assistance, including the local IRS offices and the Community Tax Law Project at 804-358-5855 or online at www.ctlp.org. In other news, the Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority, or RRHA, which owns and manages about 4,100 units of public housing in Richmond, has said its next big redevelopment project will be Gilpin Court in Jackson Ward, home to 783 families. But a coalition of public housing residents and community groups called Residents of Public Housing in Richmond Against Mass Evictions, or REFRAME, is concerned that history may repeat itself. In 1999, RRHA started the redevelopment of the Blackwell public housing community by demolishing all 440 units. Today, only 75 similarly priced units stand in their place, and the project as a whole still is not complete. RRHA says it's under strict orders to restructure public housing, but isn't getting funding to make it happen. Regardless of funding, REFRAME members insist that RRHA make a commitment of one-for-one replacement of any public housing units torn down. With this week's news you can use, This is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is minimum wage. As of July 24th, 2008, the state minimum wage is $6.55 per hour. The minimum wage will increase to $7.25 per hour on July 24, 2009. Tips may be credited toward the minimum wage, except you must be paid at least $2.13 per hour, regardless of any tips you receive. If lodging and meals usually are furnished by your employer, the reasonable value of these items also can be credited toward the minimum wage. Generally, time and a half must be paid for all hours over 40 hours worked in a week. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's Legal Term of the Week.
If you're just joining us, this is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright, and we're here in the studio with this week's question and answer session. We have our questioner here. Would you tell us your name and where you're from?
Christy from Richmond.
Welcome to the show, Christy. What's your question for us this week?
I had a question on domestic violence.
Okay, go ahead.
The question is, what if the other person that put a charge on you started the violence?
Now, is this a criminal charge the other person has put on you? Is it a civil, non-criminal case, or is it both? If you're not sure, that's fine.
Not sure.
Okay, that's fine. Well, I think that gives me enough information to answer, at least the civil, non-criminal side of it. In the criminal law, things are very much different. There, the state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person who is charged with the crime, whether it's assault and battery or something of that nature, actually committed that crime. And I'm not going to deal with that because we don't deal with criminal law. We deal with civil law. And on the civil side, there's something called a protective order that anyone who feels that she or he is a victim or survivor of domestic violence can file a petition for a protective order. To get a protective order, there has to have been domestic violence, which is an injury or a reasonable threat of injury that would put you in reasonable fear of harm. Now, a judge who probably has not heard anything on the criminal side will hear the petition for a civil protective order. And here the standard is quite different. You simply have to prove, by the greater weight of the evidence, that there was some sort of injury or threat to injure that resulted in reasonable fear. So the mere fact that the other person has taken out a criminal warrant against you is pretty much meaningless. And the mere fact that the other person has also seeking a protective order against you is pretty much meaningless because each case gets judged on its own facts. Now, I have to sort of add a disclaimer here that if, in fact, the criminal case has already gone to trial and you have been found to have committed the criminal act that arose out of this domestic violence, you may have a problem there because that's pretty much going to show that you were the aggressor or you were at fault. But if it's simply pending charges, then the judge may take that into account. But really, the judge wants to hear what happened and how it all started and how it all escalated and who said what and who did what. And although words alone are usually not enough to get a protective order, words coupled with any type of a threat, and certainly any type of a harmful or offensive touching, even if it's just, you know, holding someone against their will or shoving them, is enough to get a protective order. It does not have to be bruises or cuts or broken bones or anything like that. Any type of offensive or harmful touching would be enough to get a protective order. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here in the law office of Esther Windmuller. She is a criminal defense lawyer, practices both in state court and federal court in the greater Richmond area as well as beyond. Welcome to the show, Esther.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's a little odd having you on the show because Central Virginia Legal Aid Society does exclusively civil non-criminal law. But what I wanted to talk about was the civil consequences of a criminal conviction. And since you're in the criminal defense area, you would be aware of that. So I'd like to start, first of all, with how does one end up getting a criminal conviction? I understand most criminal cases end in plea agreements.
That's true. And you can be charged with one thing and make an agreement to plead guilty to something else. You can agree to plead to what you were found you were charged with. You can try your case and be found guilty by a judge or a jury. So one of those things would have to happen. Either you pled guilty to something or a jury or a judge found you guilty of something for you to have a criminal conviction on your record.
And what percent, roughly, of cases end up with some sort of a plea agreement, whether it's to the original charge or to some lesser charge?
I believe that the national statistic is somewhere around 90%. So most cases are worked out, and it is a smaller percentage that actually go to trial in some way. Now, that's not to say that those cases that work out were bad results. A lot of times people are very pleased with the way that their case worked out for something, you know, with much less exposure than what they were originally facing.
And with that many cases going through the system and with that many being pled out, that really is sort of an efficient use of resources.
For the criminal justice system, it is. I mean, for each individual case, you look at each one individually and determine whether it's a case that gets worked out or a case that gets tried. But a lot of times people do things, they admit to them, they're caught red-handed walking out of the store with the goods, and so it really isn't a matter of beating those cases. It's a matter of what happens to the person afterwards.
Okay, so lead us through the plea agreement process. What happens sort of step by step?
So what happens is Joe client will come to me and say, Miss Windmuller, I have been charged with petty larceny. I've been sort of down on my luck, and I don't know what I was thinking when I walked into the store, and so I grabbed some electronic gear and I stuck it in my coat and I was walking out and they caught me and they brought me back and I told them I did it and I told them I was sorry and they charged me with grand larceny. And then I would talk to the common attorney and make sure that they had their witnesses. Sometimes people don't work at the store anymore, but assuming they had their people, they've caught this guy pretty red-handed. There's probably not a lot that can be done about it. And now the question is what is he going to get convicted of and what is the punishment going to be and what is that going to mean for this fellow afterwards?
So what happens after that? I mean, you and the Commonwealth Attorney discuss, and how does the deal work? Do you propose something to the Commonwealth Attorney? They propose something back? How does the client fit into this?
It depends. Sometimes things happen ahead of time where I say, I call the Commonwealth Attorney and say, hey, I got this guy. He's down on his luck. He lost his job. He's never been in trouble before. Can we make this into a misdemeanor, maybe a petty larceny instead of the grand larceny? And the Commonwealth Attorney may call me back and we may figure out ahead of time what's going to happen. So by the time we walk into court, we know. Other times it doesn't work that way, where we walk into court and we see who's there and the Commonwealth Attorney may say, Esther, I'd like to help you out with this one, but unfortunately this store has a, you know, no deal policy and we have to prosecute everything to the fullest and I'm going to be taking this as a grand larceny. And then, you know, if in fact we go from there, it's just a matter of working out a punishment arrangement.
So this sounds really very case-by-case and almost seat-of-the-pants type of practice.
Much of criminal law is seat-of-the-pants practice because we don't always get to know what's happening with the Commonwealth's case till we get to court.
Okay. Now, what are the usual consequences to somebody of a criminal conviction, the ones that people know about? You lose your right to vote if it's a felony, for example.
Sure. Your right to possess firearms, your right to serve on a jury. And then there's lots of consequences that sort of happen secondarily with having to do with employment and housing and public assistance and those things.
And let's talk about those things. What would be the consequences to employment if you are convicted, whether it's a plea or whether it's a conviction after a trial?
Well, everyone knows that having convictions on your record is not good for getting jobs. And that can happen sort of specifically, like if a company has a policy, no conviction, no job, or maybe you want to do something with security clearance, maybe in the military, and you don't, and you've got a certain kind of conviction on your record or conviction, then you might be just out of luck, can't get the job. Then there's the situation where people apply for jobs and an employer, you know, might be looking at a number of different people for a position, and you've got three candidates and two of them have criminal convictions and one of them doesn't, and you know how that might shake out. So then there's sort of the indirect way that having criminal offenses on your record impacts your ability to get employment.
What about barrier crimes? I've heard that there are certain jobs that you just flat out can't get because of a criminal conviction, and that's a statute.
That has to do with licensing, I think. So, for example, if you've been convicted of Medicaid fraud and then you want to run a, you know, a business where you are driving people around to, and you are receiving funds from Medicaid to drive people around that need transportation, you may not ever be able to get a contract. It may be in the regulations that you are ineligible to work in that kind of company. Or you can imagine that if you have some sort of, you know, offense against children, that you're not going to be a teacher. So we know that there are some jobs that you just can't get because you've been convicted of a certain thing.
Okay. And now what about public benefits? Is having a criminal record going to affect your ability to get public benefits in the future?
Sure. There have been some laws passed, mostly federally, that indicate that you are, you know, ineligible to get certain kinds of welfare benefits like temporary assistance for needy families, TANF, and food stamps if you've got drug convictions. And, of course, getting locked up is a big problem for getting your benefits. If you are receiving benefits, let's say you're on disability for mental health problems, and you pick up a little charge and you get locked up for a few weeks, actually more than a few weeks, 30 days, you will lose your benefits. And then you have to go through the whole process of reinstating them. And if you have mental health problems, it can be difficult to do. And then you've got people that are just don't have consistent benefits. And for things like medication, that's really important for us all.
And I'm sure that although some effort is made to medicate people when they're locked up, it's not nearly as good as when they're on the outside.
Of course not. And that has to do with the sheriff's budget. If they don't have the budget for it, nobody's getting their medications. And, you know, I think one of the scariest things about being incarcerated, there are a lot of scary things about being incarcerated, but one of them is that you do not get to control your own health care and your own, if you're having a health problem or mental health problem where you would at on the outside go to a doctor and seek services and seek help, well, you just don't have that option when you're locked up. So, yes.
Now, let's talk about housing. You mentioned that having a criminal conviction on your record could affect your ability to get housing in the future.
Absolutely. There are a lot of the public assistance housing programs, Section 8 and the like, do not allow people that have certain drug convictions usually to get housing through those programs. And not only can you not get housing, but you can't be a tenant in somebody else's housing in a lot of circumstances. So if you've got a lady that's living in public housing, has lived there, takes care of her grandkids, whatever, everything's fine, and then her son that lives in the house picks up a drug conviction, she can be thrown out of housing unless she puts her son out of the house, and that leads people to some pretty difficult decisions and people sneaking around.
And I believe there was even a U.S. Supreme Court case several years ago that said that that was perfectly okay to evict the whole family just because there was one member of the household who was in trouble with a drug charge or a drug conviction.
Sure, and not only being able to get the housing, but if you are not on the lease, then, as we all know, there's a lot of enforcement of trespassing laws and public housing, and if you don't live there, then you get started to pick up for trespassing when you go to visit, and that's common.
Well, and also they can make the tenants responsible for the guests and visitors, whether they know the guests and visitors are coming or not.
Well, that's fallen right into civil, Marty, and that's going to be your bailiwicks more than it is mine.
All right. Let's talk about the impact of a criminal conviction on sort of the ability to have your children with you. Does that impact custody and visitation decisions?
Well, all custody and visitation decisions are left to judges, and the rule is the judges make a decision based on what the best interest of the child. And you can imagine how if you have two parents that are fighting over where a kid should be and how often and how much, which has to do a lot with money, that if one person picks up a criminal charge, the other parent can say, hey, that person's not a fit parent, or that person shouldn't have unsupervised visitation, and that can negatively impact. Or if you get put in jail for a little while, obviously you can't take care of your children while you are in jail. And, you know, we all know that it's probably not a great thing for kids to know or see or be aware of their parents being incarcerated. Even if, you know, under those circumstances it's appropriate, it's still painful to children and it disrupts family life.
And what about things like student loans or your ability to get an education? If you're an ex-convict, is your criminal record going to be held against you there?
Sure. There are federal loan and grant programs that people are ineligible for if they have certain criminal convictions. And obviously, the admissions process can take into account any number of factors. And depending on where it is you want to go to school, your criminal history could work against you. Now, having said that, in some ways, it could work for somebody. They could show themselves to be an exceptional person to have gotten away from their criminal past and to be applying, and that might be the kind of diversity that some institutions of higher education might be interested in. But again, that's crime specific, because the way a person's going to get treated if they stole something versus the way they get treated if they're charged with a sex offense is going to be widely different.
And how much of this is really known to or understood by somebody who is facing criminal conviction and deciding whether or not to plead guilty to either the crime or to some lesser crime? I mean, I assume that they're focused primarily on the immediate. What's going to happen to me now? Am I going to be locked up? Am I going to have to pay a fine? What's going to happen to me now? But are these notions about future impact on education and employment and housing and public benefits and family life, are they really known to folks in that situation?
Some people get it and some people don't, and that is often a function of age. I might get a young person in here who says, I just don't want to go to jail. And I say, you don't want a felony. And they go, I don't care about that. I just don't want to go to jail. And then 3 or 4 years later, they call me and say, hey, I got to get this felony off my record. And I say, well, there's no way that can happen short of a pardon from the governor, which is highly unlikely. So you're stuck. And they're like, well, I didn't understand. And that's because they didn't want to listen. Now, lawyers will tell you felony is bad. Most people know that. Crimes of stealing on your record are bad. And good lawyers will obviously tell you you can't have firearms, you know, some of those things. But no one's going to go through this whole expansive list of the many ways that it can impact somebody when they are talking about pleading guilty. So people do have to be informed themselves about what all this means.
So I guess the lesson here is if you're facing criminal charges, ask your lawyer not only about what's going to happen right away, but what's going to happen 5 or 10 years down the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you're not satisfied with that lawyer's answer, then you find a lawyer who satisfies your curiosity about exactly what your court proceedings mean for you.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Esther Windmuller, a criminal defense lawyer in Richmond. Thank you so much for being on the show, Esther.
Thank you for having me.
This week's top three tips are about domestic violence. The first tip is that domestic violence is defined by law as any act or threat that results in injury or results in reasonable fear of injury done by a family or household member. The second tip is that survivors of domestic violence can and should petition the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court for all three types of protective orders: the 72-hour emergency order, the 15-day preliminary order, and the 2-year permanent order. The third tip is that a protective order not only can forbid further contact and future acts of family abuse, but also decide child custody and visitation, possession of a home and a vehicle, and order anything else needed for protection. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered or any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Of the 8,100 children and youth currently in foster care in Virginia, almost one-third of them will never have a permanent family again. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, Attorney Christy Mara at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, speaks for children in foster care so they can have the opportunity to build permanent family connections and have the supports to transition to productive adulthood. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebright.